And welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming on this Wednesday morning. It's lovely to be back. All right, so let's settle in. Finding a place where you can settle in your own mind and body. Letting the heart show up too. Eyes open or eyes closed, whichever feels right. And whether your eyes are open or closed, getting a sense of visual perception. If your eyes are open, soft, gentle gaze downward, but you just might notice light or shape, color. And actually the same thing, if your eyes are closed, noticing the visual perception. Might be some light or motion. Shape. And then dropping down into the body. Getting a sense of the body in the posture that it's in, seated, standing, reclining, whichever. And holding just enough strength, alertness, uprightness in the body to arrive and land and stay attentive. Not too tight, not too loose, but also relaxing. Relaxing into this time of practice together. So there's a sense of the strong back and this soft front, this soft receptivity. Sitting and knowing you're sitting as the metaphor for connecting with the posture and knowing the body just as it is. And then sensing into the breath. Nothing special to do, simply breathe and know you're breathing. There's the in-breath, the out-breath, a slight pause before the next breath begins. Just breathe and know you're breathing. And then getting a sense of your own heart today. What is this state of heart? Just an acknowledging and an allowing. However it is, letting it belong. And also meeting, greeting the state of mind this morning. However it is, letting there be some space around it. Nothing right, nothing wrong, or actually it's all right. None of it is wrong. It just is. And bringing to mind that image of all of us here together, all the little squares on the screen, of each one of us popping in and coming into this time of dedicating this time to practice, to awareness together. Being here together for this time is a profound act of care. It's really an act of love. Showing up with your whole self, just as you are. This beautiful practice of Sangha reminds me of Rumi's teaching. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make sense anymore. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. I will just sit breathing in that space. Welcome back. I think arriving meditation is really important. These times of transition from whatever you were doing before to coming into practice, to have time to arrive and land, to settle. It always helps me a lot to attend and to be attentive. I want to talk a little bit this morning about perspective, a little bit of equanimity, a little bit of interconnection, given the state of our world and how difficult things are, the unimaginable amount of suffering and tragedy that there is in so many places, especially in Ukraine right now. And I don't know how to make sense of it. You know, I really don't. I think there are lots of ways to think about it, but I think it's extremely painful for most of us. And so what came to mind as I was thinking about what could I possibly offer that might feel helpful, that might just bring us together in a way to think about how do we be with the tragedies of the world and the joys, but in the context of the Dharma, and how does the Dharma help us with this? So it made me think of Carl Sagan, the great late astronomer, who did so much work on perspective. And I want to read to you this amazing piece that you might be familiar with called the pale blue dot. Anybody know it? Anybody know it? Couple people. Okay, so Carlita is going to share a picture, and then I'm going to read you a piece. So check this out. Can you see that tiny little dot there? Carlita, can you use your cursor? And yeah, there you go. So see that? There you go. So here's the piece. This is an excerpt from Carl Sagan's book, The Pale Blue Dot, and it was inspired by this image that was taken by Sagan's suggestion on Voyager 1 on February 14th, 1990. As the spacecraft left our planetary neighborhood for the fringes of the solar system, engineers turned it around for one last look at its home planet. Voyager 1 was about 6.4 billion kilometers, that's 4 billion miles away, and approximately 32 degrees above the ecliptic plane when it captured this portrait of our world. Caught in the center of scattered light rays, a result of taking the picture so close to the sun, Earth appears as a tiny point of light, a crescent only 0.12 pixel in size. Look at that dot again. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, even hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph, they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner, how frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there's no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There's nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit, yes. Settle, not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It's been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There's perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, he said, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish this pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Isn't that something? Just something, you know, and that line that says, we're here on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. It gives me chills because it's true. What are we doing? When we get that is like the biggest perspective I know that we can get about who we are, how small we are, but the impacts that we have. And so it takes me to these basic, profoundly important teachings, these three universal facts of life, the truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, pain, suffering, challenge, anxiety, and lastly, the truth of our interconnectedness, and that we have an illusion of being separate. We really do live in that illusion that I am my separate self and I can do whatever I want and it's up to me. And it does feel like that. And, you know, we're raised in a culture that says that, you know, this mastery of independence, when in fact, that is an illusion because we need each other so much. There's nothing that truly exists in isolation, nothing. And that the suffering comes from the illusion that we are separate. And the cultivation of what are known as the three poisons or three toxic energies of greed and ill will and ignorance. Ignorance being confusion, lack of clarity, the delusion, not meaning not knowing facts or figures. And it said that so much of our suffering starts with this ignorance, starts with this place of clouded view. The clouded view that could cause the wars that are happening. You know, toward what end? What is this possibly about? When you think of us being a speck of dust out in a sunbeam, that we're, you know, that these wars are happening over differences among us or economic power. The wars around fossil fuels, the wars around you're different from me and I'm better than you, so I'm going to kill you. What are we doing? And so it's painful. It's the pain that is caused out of this ignorance is truly painful. And we know as Dharma practitioners that greed and hatred and ignorance are the cause of the suffering and that generosity, love, awareness, wisdom, non-harming are the cause for our contentment and security. Actually, our long-term viability depends on cultivating this awareness of generosity and kindness and a commitment to understanding non-harming. And just because we are here as Dharma practitioners and we know this to be true, it doesn't mean we get it right because we're human. It doesn't mean we get it right. We get caught. We get caught up in what is painful because it's hard to be a person. Because it's hard to be a person. So our job, our work, our practice is to get to know our own habits and patterns well enough to see how permutations of greed, permutations of ill will take root inside us. And to do the work to not let it hijack us, to not let it degrade who we are. And when we're caught in those places, to use the medicine of loving kindness, of compassion for self and others to help uproot those tendencies. Because we are so deeply human. So coming to any kind of practice like this, any kind of meeting of a sangha, wherever you do it, however, wherever, with whomever, when the intention is to cultivate goodness, to really take heart that it is good that we are doing this. So before we move into our longer meditation, do you have any comments, additions, or questions? This is a good time for us to just talk with each other before we head into our longer meditation. You're welcome to raise your Zoom hand or let Carlita know. Has anybody heard that before, the pale blue dot, that piece? Yeah, Kathleen, you'd heard it before. Every time I read it or hear it, it always gives me chills. Okay, then, no comments. Then we'll move into our meditation. It'll be about a half an hour. So finding, once again, a comfortable posture for your body. Breathing in and knowing you're breathing in. Breathing out, knowing you're breathing out. In and out, arriving and settling. And once again, turning the awareness inward so you can sense the body, both internally and externally. The touch points, the places where your body is connected to the furniture or the floor. Sensing that groundedness of the body. Drawing some gentle energy to the heart center. Inviting the heart to open, soften any amount. And as we sit quietly, inviting the mind to clear, to become balanced. Beginning with this beautiful traditional invocation. O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are, the luminous nature of your mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it, return to it. It is your home. The truth of the goodness of your heart. The wildly amazing capacity of mind. Trust it. Return over and over again. As we sit quietly, find that place for you where you can settle the mind, whether it's in the experience of the breathing, the awareness of sound, or the touch of the body, the feet on the floor or the bottom in the chair, whatever is most natural for you, where to settle your awareness, breath, body, or sound. Choose which one and try to stay there. Coming back over and over again to this place of home, beginning again, over and over again. The mind will wander. It's not a problem. Just come back. Begin again, and we'll sit quietly. there's anywhere in the body that's holding or constricted. Maybe the jaw has tightened, or tension in the shoulders. See if you can soften any amount. And very specifically, softening the muscles of the chest and the belly. Let them go so there's room to breathe, room to be. Noticing any amount of settling that's happening. Know that. Sense into any amount of ease and relaxation, even if the mind is busy, even if the mind is sleepy. Noticing the breath, sound or sensation, and how just in the noticing, the sticking with it, there is a settling that happens. Enjoy that. Rest in that awareness of settling. Resting, not needing to change it, but actually just being in it. Now, if you like, shifting the focus from this one-pointed awareness, wherever you've been, if it's been specific to the breath or sensation or sound, imagine, if you can, widening out your awareness. More natural, choiceless awareness where the mind is resting, yet aware. This is the difference between the experience of pedaling and coasting. When we hold the awareness on one point, we're gaining balance and momentum, like pedaling a bike. And then once the momentum and balance is established, you might coast. And this coasting is settling into a wider, bigger awareness so you can take it all in: sound, sensation, breath, thoughts, images. And when the balance gets shaky from this wider awareness, come back to pedaling, come back to that one point until the momentum and balance are reestablished and you widen out again. Coasting, resting in this awareness, this bigger awareness. noticing any amount of sensation or awareness of ease or peace, any amount of well-being in the mind, heart, in the body. And just as water follows the path of least resistance, so do the energies of the body. So inviting any ease, stillness, peace, any of these sensations, any of these energies that are present for you now, any amount. See if you can let that expand through your whole body, out through your limbs, legs, feet and toes, arms, hands and fingers, filling the whole torso, front, back, and sides, moving up the throat and the neck to fill the entire head and face. So the whole body is pervaded with any amount of ease and peace that has come about during this time. And resting in that, all the way out to the edges of the body. Maybe it even goes beyond the edges of the body. This ease and peace, this stillness goes beyond the edges to surround you in a sphere of peace, resting there. And it's even possible within this state of quiet that there could be some restlessness, some agitation that is also present. That's also true of how things are. More than one thing can be true at once. Ease and peace right alongside agitation or restlessness. And in this practice of formal meditation, we train in getting to know the movements of mind and heart, how these things can coexist. And we train in the coming back, not getting taken too far away by it. We train in this steadiness so we maintain perspective. And we rest in that awareness itself. Awareness itself as the ultimate resting place, says Frank Ostasevsky. We'll end this meditation with a poem from Ada Limon called Instructions for Not Giving Up. More than the fuchsia funnels break out of the crabapple tree, more than the neighbor's almost obscene display of cherry limbs shoving their cotton candy colored blossoms to the slate sky of spring rains, it's the greening of the trees that really gets to me. When all the shock of white and taffy, the world's baubles and trinkets leave the pavement strewn with the confetti of aftermath. The leaves come, patient, plodding, a green skin growing over whatever winter did to us, a return to the strange idea of continuous living despite the mess of us, the hurt, the empty. Fine then, I'll take it, the tree seems to say, a new slick leaf unfurling like a fist to an open palm. I'll take it all. Breathing in and out this all. And from here, let's move into our traditional practice of group metta. Saying out loud, anyone, anything you're thinking about that you would like to offer your kind heart to. And I'll begin. I'm thinking about all the babies in Ukraine, the babies in other war-torn places. Their hearts. Sending as much metta from my heart to theirs, that they may be well cared for. Who are you thinking about? Who are you thinking about? So I sense into the collective goodwill that's here in this room. May all beings everywhere be safe and protected and have enough to eat and have shelter, be part of a welcoming community. And that all of the good efforts that we make in our practice together be of benefit so this suffering can be eased. Oh, nobly born. Do you like that invocation? I love it. You know, it feels every time I say it to myself in my own practice, or I offer it when I'm here, there's something so deeply connective. It feels like connective tissue to me. Oh, nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Remember who you are, your luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Remember it, trust it, return to it. It is home. I remember the first time I heard it, I think it just went like that. And I think it did that because I didn't believe it. I just didn't believe it. And I think it's a practice of coming back over and over and over again to the enormity of who we are and who we are together, and this huge perspective of how big we are and how small we are, and that the act of coming back over and over again, how that deepens our roots, and these roots of the goodness of our heart, this clarity of mind that we can cultivate, it's just critically important. Is a beautiful chapter title from this book of Brian Doyle's called One Long River of Song. It says that the small is huge, that the tiny is vast, that pain is part and parcel of the gift of joy, and that this is love. What a chapter title. It's amazing. Let me read that to you again. That the small is huge, that the tiny is vast, that pain is part and parcel of the gift of joy, and that this is love. That mote of dust in the sunbeam, right? So that piece, O Nobly Born, that comes from many Buddhist texts, but it also relates to the first principle in Buddhist psychology, which is known as the Abhidhamma. And this first principle says to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. As a number one principle, we train in seeing the nobility and beauty of all beings. And this is like when the Buddha, I equate that to the Buddha's teaching in Metta, where he says, where he teaches, you can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. That's another one that you might think, oh yeah, well, that doesn't apply to me. How am I supposed to do that? Oh, nobly born. Yes, it does. It applies to every one of us to train in this work, this practice of understanding how important each one of us is. Because when we keep doing this training towards this kindness, towards this clarity, towards compassion, it just makes our lives better and everybody's around us. This is the training in non-harming, in showing up over and over again. So when we remember, O Nobly Born, and that includes, it includes you, it includes me. I think when we think of ourselves in that way, that we are deserving of our own love, I think what happens is we get it deeper and deeper about the importance of showing up and valuing our lives, because then we show up and value others. And the second principle in the Abhidhamma is that compassion is our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnection with all things. Compassion is our deepest nature. And when we truly understand our interconnection with all things, how can we not feel it? When we're being, you know, if we really show up. And that's the other thing that the pale blue dot does for me, is it's so awe-inspiring to know that this earth is just this tiny speck in this unimaginably vast cosmos. Yet what we do has such a big impact. To be on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. There have been a few books that I've read lately that I want to tell you about that have had an impact on me related to all of this, related to how I see myself, how I see the world, and specifically training in mindfulness and how this works. So the three books, one is called Smile, written by Sarah Ruhl, R-U-H-L. The second book is My Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor. And the third book is Frank Ostasevsky's book, The Five Invitations. So let me tell you first about each one of them and why they really, their impact on me and how it relates. So Smile by Sarah Ruhl is, she's a playwright. And it's the story of her experience with getting Bell's palsy, which is a virus that attacks the seventh cranial nerve and often causes one-sided facial paralysis. And this came about after she had her twins, just a couple of days after she had twins. She already had a three-year-old, and then she had twins, and then her face drooped. And you can get this book, and she tells this story. And what was so interesting to me about it was not only her courage, her ability to truly be in this process of, number one, what is it like to have twins? I don't know. I know what it's like to have a child, but just the intensity of a baby in and of itself and having twins takes everything to stay present with that and work with your own body and all of it. But one of the things that came out of this that was so poignant is that because she had this facial paralysis, she couldn't smile. She literally couldn't smile. And there are many concerns she had around that. And one of them is that babies respond to parents' facial expressions. and she couldn't express in a natural way what was in her heart. And so she started practicing with this experience of having the full range of emotions, like any of us would have, but they couldn't be physically expressed because her face wouldn't work. So how did her children know she felt joy or sadness or anger when she had half a face that worked and then the other face side had to work so hard to accommodate? And it doesn't quite do that. And so it brought me to this awareness that oftentimes we hear in meditation instructions. This came from Thich Nhat Hanh. Breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I smile. And I thought, how do those meditation instructions work if you can't smile? What really happens here? And as somebody who guides meditation, I am very aware of the instructions that I give, that they be accessible. And I realized maybe they're not always accessible for all bodies. And so there's a story that goes with that instruction from Thich Nhat Hanh that comes from Pema Chodron, who said that when Thich Nhat Hanh said to me, breathing in, know I'm breathing in. And when you breathe out, smile, lift the corners of your mouth. Because what it does is it relaxes the facial muscles and it sends a neurological message to the brain of well-being. The smile literally tells the brain, oh, you feel good. That's what a smile does. But what if you can't do that? So you can't make that neurological connection. So the story from Pema is that she said to Thich Nhat Hanh, you're asking me to smile, but I'm not happy. And you can't just tell me to be happy. And he said, I'm not asking you to be happy. I'm asking you to smile. And before I read this book from Sarah Ruhle, that made a lot of sense to me, that the physical action of smiling didn't depend on whether I was happy or not, my level of contentedness. It was a physical action to actually tell the mind and the face that it could relax. So Sarah Ruhle talks about what this was like, and she herself is a meditation practitioner. So she has some Dharma background. And so she talked about how she could feel emotions, particularly joy, but not be able to express that. I don't have a specific, you know, like aha from this, like to say, and therefore, but therefore, what are the assumptions that we make about how anybody is, how I am? Is my smile, my ability to smile, is not the only indicator of what might be happening on the inside? So it's an interesting thing to think about. How we can sense emotion, energies in the body that don't necessarily come out physically. And what do we require of ourselves in these, physical expressions? So that led me to read Jill Bolte Taylor, My Stroke of Insight. And some of you, tell me who's familiar with this book, Nancy, great, Kathleen, Jane, Carlita. It's a fascinating book. And Jill Bolte Taylor is a neuroanatomist. She, at the time, I don't know where she works now, but she was working in the Harvard Brain Bank. And in 1996, at age 37, she had a stroke, which is very unusual for somebody in their 30s to have a stroke. And what I learned from this book is that because of where the bleed happened in her left hemisphere, because of her training as a brain scientist, as a neuroanatomist, because of just everything about her, she was able to literally watch the experience of this stroke in her brain and how it changed her perceptions and what she was able to do, see, hear, everything as it occurred, which is absolutely fascinating to have that kind of presence and stability to stick with it, just to stick with it and to watch it and experience it. And the book is absolutely fascinating. I highly recommend it. And she goes through a very, very detailed explorations and descriptions of what is happening in the left brain, what is happening in the right brain, what parts of the brain are responsible for what and how they interact. But one of the things that she learned is that any emotion that comes around, it only lasts for up to 90 seconds. So she would notice anger arise, and it really only lasted 90 seconds. But what happens after that up to 90 seconds is that's where the cognitive choice comes in of how are we in relationship with whatever that emotional experience is. So you might have the feeling of feeling anger for hours or days or an undercurrent of it going on and on. But what she learned is the reality is the literal presence of it activating the brain is really short, up to 90 seconds. But after that, how we relate to the presence of that emotion, that's the choice point. And when I think about what is mindfulness, one of the things I think is really true of mindfulness is choice, is really choice. How are we in relationship with whatever is arising? And one of the things that she did, she said that it took her 8 years to fully recover. And she lost in that morning, this 4-hour period, she lost her ability to read and to write and all these skills that we take for granted. And she had to relearn how to read, how to write. She needed to relearn the names of foods or even know that what is red, to relearn colors. Extraordinary. And she had the determination and the ability through dogged determination to recover, to rehab. And it took her a full 8 years. But back to this point of choice, what she noticed in this is you know the teaching that says, that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind from the Buddha, right? That where we place our attention, that's where we're going to strengthen in the mind, or where the mind goes, energy flows, however you want to say that. What she knew is that as she was healing, she had a choice of the parts of herself that she wanted to bring back and the parts she didn't. And that was fascinating to me. She talked about that she had an inclination towards being judgmental, and she had a mean part of herself. And what she learned through this stroke and through all of the efforts it took from everybody who helped her rehab was the absolute essential necessity of kindness and compassion, and that it had to start inside of her. And that because the stroke happened on the left side, it's the right side of the brain that is mostly responsible for ease and peace. And that place where we go, that sense of things are really okay, that comes from the right brain, that more creative side. The left side is more linear, figuring stuff out. And so she had this experience of incredibly deep peace in the experience of the stroke. And so she knew the truth of the third noble truth, peace is possible. She had that direct experience of that awe and bliss, and that everything was really okay, even though it wasn't okay because she's having this stroke. But what she knew is that because that was possible, she did not have to retrain in the places of her tendencies that she didn't like, that were unpleasant for her. She did not want to bring back that ability to be what she said was mean or unkind And so she made the choice to not nurture that, to not let that come back. Isn't that fascinating? We really do have this ability to recognize all parts of ourselves and nurture. This is the training. When the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering, the big overarching teaching, what are we going to do to increase our own well-being and that of others? And what are we going to do to decrease the suffering? We really can do this. And so then that led me to reading Frank Ostasevsky, The Five Invitations. Who's read that? Let's see. Okay, a couple of us. Fascinating, gorgeous book. Frank is a longtime Dharma teacher. He was one of the founders of San Francisco Zen Hospice Project and widely loved metta teacher. And his book, Five Invitations to Live a Vibrant Life Within the Truth That We're Going to Die. And the five invitations are: one, don't wait. The second, welcome everything, push away nothing. The third one, bring your whole self to the experience. The fourth one, rest in the middle of things. And the last one, don't know mind. I'm on my way through a second read of it. It's just a very, very beautiful book and highly recommend it. But here's the thing. In the section on bring your whole self to the experience, this is this practice, isn't it? Of how are we truly present with everything? Watching the movements of the mind and heart, and how do we find and cultivate this equanimity within it? So he gives an image that what if you had a big, huge cardboard cutout of yourself, and you ran it through a laser cutter and turned yourself into a giant jigsaw puzzle. And then you mix up all the pieces, and here's a picture of Heidi, you know, with all these characteristics of myself, but it's not just the outer characteristics. It's also all the inner characteristics are also cut into all of these jigsaw puzzle pieces. And you start to put your puzzle together. You start to put yourself back together. What do you include? What do you immediately include? What are the parts of yourself that you want to include? What do you leave out? What do you leave out? What do you want to be seen? What are the parts of yourself you don't want to be seen? Shape, color, size, feelings, roles, and identities. What belongs easily? What do you pick first? And what do you leave for last? So just think about that for yourself. What if you were this jigsaw puzzle? What are those parts that you choose to include, the parts you love and admire and nurture in yourself? And what are the parts you don't want to see that you want to leave out? Just like Jill Bolte Taylor said, I'm not going to do that anymore. What are the parts you're not even sure of? Like, oh, what's this puzzle piece? I have no idea where that goes. It's an interesting practice, isn't it? So this practice of inclusivity, knowing who we are, letting ourselves be recognized. I want to read you a story from Jack's book, The Wise Heart. This is Jack Kornfield's book, The Wise Heart. So here's a beautiful story. Some years ago, I heard the story of a high school history teacher who knew a secret. On a particularly fidgety and distracted afternoon, she told her class to stop all their academic work. She let her students rest while she wrote on the blackboard a list of names of everyone in the class. And then she asked them to copy the list. She instructed them to use the rest of the period to write beside each name one thing they liked or admired about the student. and at the end of the class, she collected all the papers. Weeks later, on another difficult day just before winter, the teacher again stopped the class. She handed each student a sheet with his or her name on top, and on it she had pasted all 26 good things the other students had written about that person. They smiled and gasped in pleasure that so many beautiful qualities were noticed about them. 3 years later, this teacher received a call from the mother of one of her former students. Robert had been a cut-up, but also one of her favorites. His mother sadly passed on the terrible news that Robert had been killed in the Gulf War. The teacher attended the funeral where many of Robert's former friends and high school classmates spoke. And just as the service was ending, Robert's mother approached her. She took out a worn piece of paper, obviously folded and refolded many times, and said, "This was one of the few things in Robert's pocket when the military retrieved his body." It was the paper on which the teacher had so carefully pasted the 26 things that his classmates had admired. Seeing this, Robert's teacher's eyes filled with tears. As she dried her wet cheeks, another former student standing nearby opened her purse, pulled out her own carefully folded page, and confessed that she'd always kept it with her. A third ex-student said that this page was framed and hanging in his kitchen. Another told how the page had become part of her wedding vows. The perception of goodness invited by this teacher had transformed the hearts of her students in ways she might only have dreamed about. Oh, nobly born, right? You who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, remember who you are. Remember who you are. You can search the whole world over and not find anyone more deserving of your love than yourself. To let ourselves be seen by each other, to let ourselves belong, and to have that sense of being connected to something so much bigger than us. But how do we get there? You know, that sounds beautiful. It sounds wonderful. And it is. But it's not so easy to get necessarily from point A to B, C, D, E, F, and include it all. So this is where the practice of faith comes in. This practice of trust and confidence. And the Pali word, the language of the Buddha for faith, is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. And my understanding is that the literal translation is to place the heart upon. That's what sadha is. So to move into this practice of connection and belonging, we need some trust. We need some confidence. We need faith. And it's said in the Buddhist teachings that the proximate cause for faith is suffering. The proximate cause for faith, for trust, is suffering. So if you think about the times that you have experienced great pain, challenge, what is it that keeps you going? What is it? Is it coming back to Sangha, the different kinds of Sangha, the different practices we have? We need to have some ability to say, I can do this faith. There's different kinds of faith from the perspective of this practice. It's said that there are four kinds of faith: bright faith, borrowed faith, verified faith, and abiding faith. So the first kind of faith, this bright faith, that's like when you get your first taste of the Dharma and you say, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. And perhaps you've felt that. I certainly did. That's why I'm still here. That sense of coming to this practice and saying, oh, I get it. This fits me. And then it's kind of like falling in love, and one can get completely single-minded and think that it's going to be the answer to everything, this infatuation. Like, we're all in. I found my true home. And it's a beautiful moment when we fall in love with something that we know is so deeply nurturing and feels so wholesome. The Zen teacher Rafe Martin says, part of this experience, what happens is maybe we step out again after sitting a little lighter, after that sitting, we're a little lighter, a little steadier, a little happier, a little less heavier there, a bit more present here, and so a bit more capable of just a little more spontaneous kindness and generosity. Right? We get a taste. Oh, this is good. And then, you know how falling in love and infatuation works. The shine starts to rub off. Something happens and you think, eh, I don't feel like sitting today. Or I don't like what that teacher said. Or this doesn't work. I'm suffering anyway. I don't want to do this. I think we all know that, where the doubts come in, we get a little unsteady, and we need some support. We need support. You know, there's different kinds of doubt. There's the doubt that keeps us stuck, that says, ah, that's no good. I'm not doing that. And there's the doubt that says, well, wait a minute. It really helped last time. I think I'll go again. I think I'll sit again. That's a really juicy kind of functional doubt. But we need to borrow some faith. So after the bright faith starts to dim, we move to this place of borrowed faith, which says, I'm going to go with my friend and show up at Sangha because it's still working for that person. So I'm going to go hang on. Or we talk to a friend and say, this is what's going on. I don't really think this meditation stuff works. And the friend says, come on, let's just go sit together. And we borrow a little bit. Or we come back to the refuges, knowing the beauty of taking refuge, of trusting our inner wisdom, refuge in the Buddha, this inner wisdom that we too can wake up, trusting, taking refuge in the Dharma, the truth of things, what the Buddha taught, these teachings, and especially borrowing the faith of the refuge in the Sangha. We are here together. We all must be doing something. I'm just going to show up and be with you because it's going to rub off on me. And that's what gives us the ability to begin again. We come back and we borrow the faith in the precepts that if I really undertake a training of taking good care of myself, I'll be able to help take good care of others. My training in non-harming is borrowing some faith. Here's a practice that Jack gives us around this borrowed faith. This is called seeing the secret goodness. Wait for a day when you awaken in a fine mood, when your heart is open to the world. If such days are rare, choose the best you have. Now that is faith, right? Choose the best you have. Before you start work, set the clear intention that during the morning you'll look for the inner nobility of three people. Carry that intention in your heart as you speak or work with them. Notice how this perception affects your interaction with them, how it affects your own heart, how it affects your own work. Then choose five more days of your best moods and do this practice on each of those days. After looking at three people a day in this way, five times, set the clear intention to practice seeing the secret goodness for a whole day with as many people as you can. Of course, you will find certain people difficult. That's natural. Save them for later. And practice first with those whose nobility and beauty is most easily seen. When you have done this as best you can for a day, choose one day a week to continue this practice for a month or two. Then it becomes habit. Finally, as you become more naturally able to see the secret goodness, expand your practice, add more days, try practicing on days that are more stressful, gradually include strangers and difficult people until your heart learns to silently acknowledge and bless all whom you meet. Aim to see as many beings as you can with a silent, loving respect. And here's the real teaching. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. Go through the day as if you were the Dalai Lama undercover. Isn't that great? This is borrowing faith. We start getting that rooted. And then there's the verified faith. Verified faith is we start finding our footing from our direct experience. We do that secret, seeing the secret goodness practice, and we find out that it works. That is that verified confidence and trust that we get, the benefit of practice, that we know something good is actually happening here. And this comes back from the Buddha's teaching around find out from your direct experience. He says, don't believe me. Find it out. Go do it yourself and see what happens. Abraham Lincoln said it really well. When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. If it were just so simple, but it kind of is when we're paying attention. So that's the verified faith. And we can use a compass question that the Buddha also gave us that says, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? That's a beautiful guiding question that also engenders this confidence and trust. What when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? So we start trusting ourselves. We start having a growing confidence. And then we move into abiding faith. That is that undercurrent that's just always there, that confidence. We can use these words interchangeably, whether it's faith, whether it's confidence, whether it's trust. And it's grown out of wisdom and equanimity that becomes a continual resource of support. That we just trust in the goodness of ourselves and each other, that we actually can manage the difficulties. So I'm going to read you one more piece. And again, this comes from Brian Doyle. So this is one of my favorite books. I want to tell you about it. It's called One Long River of Song. And Brian Doyle is no longer of this earth. He died of a brain tumor in his early 60s, but he was a prolific and brilliant writer. So this is a couple of pages. This is called The Hawk. Recently, a man took up residence on my town's football field, sleeping in a small tent in the northwestern corner near the copse of cedars. He'd been a terrific football player some years ago for our high school, and then had played in college, and then a couple of years in the nether reaches of the professional ranks, where a man might get paid $100 a game plus bonuses for touchdowns and sacks. Then he'd entered into several business ventures, but these had not gone so well, and he'd married and had children, but that had not gone so well either. And finally, he'd taken up residence on the football field because, he said, that was where good things happen. That's where it had gone well, and he sort of needed to get balanced again, and there was something about that field that was working for him, as far as he could tell. So with all due respect to people who thought he was a nutcase, he decided he would stay there until someone made him leave. He'd already spoken with the cops, and it was a mark of the general decency of our town that he was told he could stay as long as he didn't interfere with the use of the field, which of course he would never think of doing. And it was summer anyway, so the field wasn't in much use. He'd been nicknamed the Hawk when he was a player for his habit of lurking around almost lazily on defense and then making a stunning strike. And he still speaks of the way he played, quietly, but then amazingly. When we sat on the visiting team's bench the other day, he said some quietly amazing things, which I think you should hear. The reporter from the paper came by, he said. She wanted to write a story about the failure of the American dream and the collapse of the social contract, and she was just melting to use football as a metaphor for something or other, and I know she was just trying to do her job, but I kept telling her things that didn't fit what she wanted, like that people come by and leave me cookies and sandwiches, and that kids who play lacrosse at night set up a screen so my tent won't get peppered with stray shots, and the cops drift by at night to make sure no one's giving me grief. Everyone gets nailed at some point, so we understand someone getting nailed and trying to get back up on his feet again. I am not a drunk, and there's no politicians to blame. I just lost my balance. People are good to me. You try to get lined up again. I keep the field clean. Mostly it's discarded water bottles, lost cell phones I hang in a plastic bag by the gate. I don't have anything smart to say. I don't know what things mean. Things just are what they are. I never sat on the visitor's bench before, did you? Someone leaves coffee for me every morning by the gate. The other day, a lady came by with twin infants, and she let me hold one while we talked about football. That baby weighed about half of nothing. You couldn't believe a human being could be so tiny, and that there were two of him. That reporter, she kept asking me what I had learned and what I would say to her readers if there was only one thing I could say. And when I told her what could possibly be better than standing on a football field holding a brand new human being the size of a coffee cup, you know what I mean? Everything else is sort of a footnote. Now that is faith, right? That is confidence and trust. And all of our practice can be an expression of this, to place our heart upon a commitment to practice and trust and confidence. Everything else is just sort of a footnote. I love that. So this is the discovery and the cultivation of our inner nobility, of the truth that he knew he could love himself deeply. And I think that it's a summary. It's another expression of what Rumi said. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make sense anymore. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.